It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Biden administration will ban mining for 20 years on hundreds of thousands of acres of watershed in the Superior National Forest near Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Call in with your thoughts and questions about the mining ban. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Knopp is executive director of the Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness, which has fought against copper sulfide mining near this vast preserve. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, hey, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here with you and everyone on Wisconsin Public Radio.
So the Interior Department's ban applying to about 225,000 acres of the Superior National Forest. How significant is this ban?
Kate, this is a huge step forward. It's a vote for clean water and all the jobs that depend on clean water in the outdoor industry in Northeast Minnesota. So it's a huge step forward. There's still much to do, but this is a great step forward for everyone who loves the Boundary Waters Canoe Area and the clean water of Northeast Minnesota.
What are the environmental concerns you have about mining in this area?
Sure. It's sort of broader context for this is that this type of mining, Kate, has never been done in Minnesota. So this is not the traditional iron taconite mining in Minnesota. So this is copper mining. And with the rock formation here in Northeast Minnesota, with that copper in the ore, you also have sulfide. And so when the rock is broken up and it brought to the surface and exposed to air and water, you create sulfuric acid. And so in a region where you're bounded by the largest Great Lake and the largest freshwater lake in the world on one side and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area with over 1,000 lakes, you're going to have a problem with that. And the amount of waste, Kate, in this process is just enormous. So the ore is not 50% of the rock or 25% of the rock or 10% of the rock or even 1%. It's less than 0.5%. So you're going to have 99.5% waste exposed to air and water, creating sulfuric acid. So that's the environmental risk that we're concerned about.
And what you're saying here, you know, iron ore mining has a long history and tradition in Minnesota, but this would be a very much new territory, mining for copper and nickel and precious metals, which hasn't been done before in Minnesota.
It's exactly right. This is not the mining that has been done for a century in Minnesota. So this is much different and poses a much different risk to the environment.
If there are no active mineral leases currently on this land affected by the moratorium, do you see this as a preemptive move, a preemptive measure?
It is. That's correct. It's a preemptive measure. It's also, there was a particular mine called Twin Metals that is within this area. And so the history of this is that Twin Metals had a predecessor had a mineral lease going back to the 1960s, and that mineral lease expired in 2016, and so that lease expired, and then there was a political and legal fight back and forth, and we were in federal court for the last few years with Twin Metals, and that lease was canceled over a year ago, and so this moratorium for the next 20 years, it really really ends the Twin Metals effort and is an opening for us to look forward to a future in Minnesota where we look at other ways to diversify and make these communities strong in Northeast Minnesota.
We're talking about mining near the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northern Minnesota with Chris Knopp, who is Executive Director of Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. You can join in along the way at 800-642-1234. Chris, you know, the order that blocks this Minnesota company's proposal to mine for copper, nickel, and other minerals near Ely, company officials have said the metals are needed for making solar and wind technology and electronic vehicles. Does the mining ban risk delaying the nation's or Minnesota's clean energy goals?
You know, not at all. It's a misleading argument. Really, the proposed Twin Metals mine that is encompassed in this geographic area, it would only produce, if it were operating, 0.18% of the copper in the global market. So copper is a global market, and twin metals would just be a drop in the bucket. So it's truly misleading to say that this is needed for the clean energy economy. And so this is it, it's not it, this is not the mine that's necessary for the clean energy economy. And so really the question we have to ask is, where you do this, and you're doing this is in an area where you have all this water, so you're going to have pollution. And these mining companies and the proponents for this copper sulfide mining really need to be honest with the public that if we do have these mines, we're going to poison this the environment here of Northeast Minnesota. So it's the argument is we need to destroy the environment in order to save the environment, and that's not one I buy. So this is not needed for the green energy economy.
We heard from Jennifer in Waukesha, called in to say that they are overjoyed to hear about the imposition of a mining ban to protect the boundary waters. And they said it's been a long battle. Jennifer has canoed there many times, also worked for an area outfitter while they were a college student. Chris, can you speak to the area's recreation economy and what that brings?
Sure. Kate, the three counties in Northeast Minnesota, the outdoor industry is over a $500 million industry. Each year, $540 million are generated by the outdoor recreation economy there. And so you have hundreds of jobs in the outfitters that both in the winter, there are winter campers, and as well as canoeists in during the summer that are dependent upon the clean water. And if that water is poison, those jobs go away. So these mines threaten existing jobs.
Can we just pause here and maybe just make space for you to find words for just the beauty and remoteness of this vast wilderness for people who haven't visited the Boundary Waters?
Kate, this is a special place. If you can imagine a place where you can see every star in the sky, where you can hear every thought in your head, because there's just the sound of the waves lapping against the shore, a loon calling at night, and surrounded by granite shoreline, soaring pine trees, and clean water everywhere. That's what the Boundary Waters is about, and it's about connecting with yourself and connecting with your friends and family that go on those special trips with you. That's the Boundary Waters.
Chris Knopp leads the environmental advocacy group Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. Call in with your questions about the federal government's mining ban near the Boundary Waters. Share your views on it. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discussed the Biden administration's 20-year moratorium on mining, protecting nearly 250,000 acres of wilderness in northern Minnesota near the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Call in with your thoughts, your questions about mining activity, the environmental impacts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Knopp heads up the conservation group Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness and stays with us. Chris, you characterize this as one step in, it sounds like, a multi-step process here for protection efforts. Closing mining to federal lands within the Superior National Forest. Could a mine be built on privately owned land and affect the ecosystem of the Boundary Waters? Or are there other leases you're concerned with in the proximity to this wilderness area?
Sure. Thanks for that question, Kate. There's sort of the next step beyond this. At the federal level, we support legislation by Congresswoman Betty McCullum from Minnesota here to make that 20-year moratorium permanent. And so that's at the federal level. That's legislative protection that we're supporting. At the state level, we support a bill called Prove It First. And this is an idea that we actually took from Wisconsin. Wisconsin had this law in place from 1998 until 2017. And Prove It First is just a very simple, straightforward law. And it would require any of these sulfide mining companies to first prove that this has been done safely elsewhere in the U.S. for at least 10 years, and that the mine has been closed for 10 years without causing pollution before it's been done in Minnesota. So it's a straightforward question that puts front and center whether this type of mining can be done safely. So at the state level, we're looking for protection of through prove it first, and we're at the state level is where we think we can really make some progress to get the legislative protection in place here.
Do you think prove it first goes far enough? I mean, you saw as in 2017, Wisconsin's legislature repealed the moratorium that had required companies to prove other mines operated and were closed for 10 years without environmental harm. So how do you make sure something like that is permanent and sustains for longevity?
Sure. In one sense, it's tough to make anything permanent. All laws can be overturned. All administrative actions can be overturned. And so it's really a multi-layered approach. And so we have in our advocacy work, three levels of our work. We have a litigation, legislation that we've been talking about, and then citizen action. And ultimately, once we get prove it first passed, for sure it could be overturned, as Scott Walker did with the prove it first law in Wisconsin. But the third part of with citizen action and really supporting the communities of Northeast Minnesota and having broad-based public support is where we really enshrine that support. So we have an office in Ely, the community that's the center of the gateways to the Boundary Waters. And we're working with community members to look at ways in which we can have broad-based efforts to strengthen Ely and the other communities in Northeast Minnesota. And I think having that public support is the ultimate protection that we need. So public support, success in the course that we've had, and legislative support. It's a multi-layer way of ensuring protection.
We have a question here from Chuck in Juneau called to say that they spent a month last summer camping in the Boundary Waters and in Voyageurs National Park, and is wondering if this mining ban protects Voyageurs National Park if that there are other protections in mining regulations for Voyageurs.
Sure. Thanks for that question. So this the proposed Twin Metals mine was upstream from Voyageurs National Park. So the path of pollution from Twin Metals would have gone through the Boundary Waters and then into Voyageurs National Park and then into Canada. So this moratorium for 20 years provides that protection for Voyageurs National Park, and having a permanent ban on it through federal legislation would provide that permanent protection.
Let's go to Perry now in Oconto. Perry, hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, I just want to commend the Friends of the Boundary Waters for the great work in getting people just to come together to work to get the legislation done and to hold our politicians accountable. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things is just that people power. And just if you hold something near and dear to speak up and find a group and that, because over here in Oconto we have PFAS here that just a report a week or two ago was all in Great Lakes fish, which is a big industry over here. And I've talked for several years to politicians, and it's like, oh, I'm in Door County, I don't have to worry about PFAS in Marinette County. Well, there's millions and billions of dollars now in the fishing industry that says that the fish are worse than drinking a month worth of contaminated water with one fish. So,
Perry, thank you for the call, and certainly Perry bringing up the environmental concerns of PFAS contamination, forever chemicals in water and contaminating drinking water. Chris, what are your insights there on how a Friends group can affect change?
Sure. Perry's comments bring up this statement from former Vice President Walter Mondale that every environmental victory is temporary, and every environmental defeat is permanent. And these mines would poison the water for centuries. And so that people power that Perry was talking about, that's what I was getting at, as that third pillar of the advocacy there, and having the support of individuals who love the boundary waters, who love clean water, contact their elected officials, really makes that difference.
Talking about the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northern Minnesota with Chris Knopp, Executive Director of Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, what do you see in terms of climate change? How is the climate crisis affecting the Boundary Waters?
Kate, the climate crisis is at the Boundary Waters right now. So we are very focused on all the threats to the Boundary Waters, not just sulfide mining, but climate change as well. And so right now there are at least three major impacts of climate change on the Boundary Waters. First, you have the change in the boreal forest. So the pine trees and the birch trees that dot that landscape, those are starting to change into oak and maple forest. So we have a changing forest, and this change, Kate, is not just one that can happen slowly. That if we have two ill-timed warm spells in the late winter, early spring, in two consecutive years, that entire boreal forest can be killed off from the Boundary Waters to the Hudson Bay. So this is an immediate problem for the forest. And second, we have warming waters. The Boundary Waters has these great trout lakes that need cold water, and the warming climate threatens those trout lakes. And then finally, the changing climate brings in invasive species that alter the landscape and crowd out native species. So those are happening right now in the Boundary Waters. So we're very focused on that. For example, the warming climate pushes moose out, and we have had over the last three decades, rapid decline in moose population. So we're very concerned about all these impacts of climate change on the Boundary Waters, and are working to advocate for protection of our climate.
What is your friends group working on next with this moratorium in place?
We have three pillars of our work. We've been talking about wilderness advocacy. We also are about people and communities. And so on the people end, Kate, we have a well-developed education program that hit its stride this year. We're reaching thousands of students in schools to talk about the Boundary Waters. And we have scholarships through our Thomas Flint Canoe Program, where we bring over 100 students on scholarships into the wilderness. And then finally, we're in the communities where we have our office in Ely, and we're reaching out to community members, and we'll be leading nature hikes. And we've bought some land at the edge of the Boundary Waters that was under threat of development. And so we'll be leading canoe paddles out this summer to that conservation land that we've bought. So we have a multi-pronged approach of wilderness advocacy, bringing people out into the wilderness, and then finally supporting the communities that are gateways to the Boundary Waters.
I want to hear a little bit more in our last minute or so about buying up land that for conservation purposes that is under threat, and the strategy behind that. Where do you see that headed in the future?
Well, there's the challenge out there that's unknown to the public, that the Spirit National Forest does not have money to buy and the other personnel resources right now to buy land at the edge of the wilderness that's coming up for sale. And that other conservation groups, larger national conservation groups, have other focus areas and other strategies. And so we're grassroots geography based organization. And so we are privately fundraising right now to buy land. So we bought 80 acres, for those of you that know the Boundary Waters, on Snowbank Lake, just about 25 minutes east of Ely. And we're now in the process of trying to protect 360 acres along the South Kuishui River, right where Twin Metals was proposed for. So we're trying to buy land that's coming up for sale there. And so we're privately fundraising for that. And we will make it open for the public to use for recreation. Mm. And we're doing it to preserve the forest and the shoreline, so that the land that we're trying to protect along the South Kuishu River has over 2 miles of undeveloped shoreline and leads right into the boundary waters.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's great to be on, and thank you to everyone in Wisconsin and Rutabaga Paddle Sports.
We're out of time here. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison writer setting the record straight on history.
Joyce Salter Johnson has loved history her entire life. But as a descendant of people who were enslaved, her family history, like the history of many Black families across the country, was largely struck from the historical record. As WPR's Christine Hatfield tells us, Johnson had to take it upon herself to uncover her family's roots.
Who we are is determined by where we come from, our parents, where they come from, their parents, where their parents come from, and a chain of unbreakable links that could explain not only our genetic makeup, but also our personalities.
Joyce Salter Johnson's love of history started with a missing link in her family's history. She says her grandmother appeared to have no roots at all. She essentially lived alone in a nice house in the South that her grandfather sent money home to build while he worked on the Illinois Central Railroad. Johnson has always been a storyteller, and the holes in her family's history left room for her curiosity to thrive. When she reached adulthood, that curiosity transformed from fantasy into research. It took years to get answers to her family's story.
Before 1866, there was nothing written in any archive about slaves. Nothing. The information that you needed to find out about the enslaved person was in the archives or the databases or the journals of the people that held them enslaved.
Eventually, she traced the Salters back to 1792, when Hardy Salter was born to enslaved parents in Virginia. The journey of the Salters took them to Good Hope, Mississippi. That's where Joyce Salter Johnson grew up. Over the years, life led Johnson to Freeport, Illinois, and eventually Madison, where she's lived for more than 30 years. But it was Freeport's Historical Society that inspired Joyce's next historical endeavor.
So for years, we would always get these really nice publications about Freeport. And often it was a historic publication about Freeport. And there was never, ever one picture of any African-American in those publications.
When she asked why, she was told there weren't records of African Americans living there, let alone pictures. So she began combing through the historical records herself, finding stories of centuries worth of Black settlers in the county.
In order for history to be accurate, it must present an inclusive record of all people. Unfortunately, in the past, a substantial portion of the history of the Negro in Stevenson County has been omitted. This omission has allowed generations of the county's residents, both Black and white, to grow up with a distorted view of Stevenson County and the roles African American have played in its development. And that's what I had to give to them, and they said, of course we'll publish your book. I place people of African descent in that time and place, in that space. Where they should have been automatically put in that space.
Johnson says she's glad to see her books as more than just family history. She says they're textbooks people can learn from. As for herself, life has carried on through the years of research and hard work. She found her way into early childhood education and led Madison's Early Childhood Learning Center, taking in children who needed extra care. At 82, her work isn't done just yet. She still has another book to write and more history to share with the world.
Joyce Salter Johnson of Madison is the author of numerous historical books. WPR's Christine Hatfield brought us her story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the USDA targeting fraud and bringing more oversight to the organic food industry. The Agriculture Department strengthened its rules and is stepping up enforcement to help make sure products labeled organic are truly organic. Call in with your questions, your comments about the new USDA regulations that go into effect next month. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Adam Wortheson is Director of Government and Industry Affairs for Organic Valley, a national cooperative of 1,800 family farmers based in Lafarge, Wisconsin. Adam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Glad to join you this morning.
So these changes the USDA made are meant to close loopholes that allowed non-organic ingredients to get by, to get organic labeling. What are these loopholes?
Well, Kate, you know, the organic industry, we've seen a lot of growth over the last 20 years, and it's increasingly become a global industry. And so when it's grown to, you know, from a few million dollars in sales at the beginning of the organic sector to now $63 billion, you've seen attempts by some actors in the space to try to, you know, penetrate that marketplace. And what you said earlier about trust being the fundamental important piece within organic is really important. So when consumers see that USDA organic seal, we need them to believe and know that it's real and organic means something. And it does. And that's what's really important. So the body of work that happened at USDA and the rule that was released called Strengthening Organic Enforcement really looked at kind of three areas of improvement. And that's what this rule does. It improves the existing regulations that are already on the books. And one of the things it does, it says those that previously weren't certified and handled product, especially from international sources, will now have to be certified. And people might wonder, well, why is that important? And the reason that's important is because if you're a certified handler or operations and you violate those rules, then you're subject to the criminal penalties and noncompliance and fines that are associated with, you know, violating the law. So that is a really important provision to put in place. Secondly, any product that comes into the United States now will have to have an import certificate. Really important set of records that demonstrate where that product came from and its origins. And then the third piece that the new rule does that I think is really important is it strengthens USDA's ability to oversee and enforce, you know, the trade rules that are in place. So if you think about who is going to be impacted by this rule, it's really handlers in large part that weren't previously certified. And then it's also the certification world. And if in organic, we have about 80 certifiers that are making sure those products that are, you know, labeled as organic are really organic.
Mm-hmm. Something that jumped out to me is these certifiers doing unannounced inspections, you know, that would require them to do these unannounced inspections for a minimum of 5% of the operations they certify annually. What impact would surprise inspections have on organic producers?
Well, I mean, I think it keeps people honest. You know, if you're going to have an inspector come in and visit you and you're not entirely ready for it, you can't cook or change the books before they show up. You're going to be reviewed right there on the spot. And, you know, that's going to give us a little bit of better insight on if anyone's sort of playing outside of the rules. So they currently do that in most cases. Most certifiers already have that domestically put in place. And actually the Department of Agriculture has a dairy compliance project where they're doing that actually themselves on some dairy farms and with some certifiers. So I think it's good practice. I would probably have to admit, I don't know that any farmer or any individual really likes that sort of unannounced inspection, but it does keep you really honest in terms of being organic. And my experience, you know, with the farmers that we work with, they are very honest and they are, you know, following those standards, and they are creating a product that, you know, does mean something in being certified organic, and they want to make sure that consumers are able to buy something that is real and means exactly what they are doing on the farm. So it levels that playing field among producers, as well as it conveys that element of trust to the ultimate purchaser of an organic gallon of milk or an organic granola bar or whatever it be at the retail level.
Does Organic Valley and the farmers you work with, the producers you work with, support these changes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we see the organic industry growing. We know it's global and it's context. And, you know, we want to make sure that everyone's playing by the same set of rules and that there is a strong enforcement mechanism. It's weird, you know, when organics was created in the 1990 Farm Bill, and then the new rules came out in 2000, and we've been updating them ever since. You know, part of the reason that came about was because we had a lot of different regulations in different states and different certifiers interpreting things in different ways. And so codifying that into one standard that, you know, facilitates commerce seems to be really important to our farmer members as well as consumers that are buying products.
But will stronger enforcement rules and meeting these new standards mean added costs for Wisconsin organic farmers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the onus falls heavily on the accredited certifiers. That's probably who's going to have to carry the biggest burden here, because there'll be additional records they'll be holding and additional entities that they'll be certifying. For our farmer membership, one of the things the rule does is it demands every certified operation has a fraud prevention plan. So there will be some additional work to create that. But overall, I don't really see for the farm side a really big sort of burden that they're carry. In most part, I think it's important because what our farmers want to make sure is that anybody can join the organic marketplace, but let's just make sure we're all joining it and competing at sort of the same understanding of the regulations. If you think about organic, it's kind of a unique in that farmers come to it voluntarily to decide they want to be an organic producer. Businesses come to it voluntarily to decide they want to try to engage in organic commerce. And consumers come to it voluntarily to decide this is the type of products they want for their families. So that's a unique regulatory sort of structure that is built on a voluntary body of participation.
And it goes back to what you said at the beginning about there is lots of trust in that model. Adam Wortheson is Government and Industry Affairs Director at Organic Valley, the farmer-owned cooperative based in Wisconsin. Join in by calling with your questions about the new USDA requirements for foods labeled as organic. Share your thoughts as a consumer, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore new regulations on foods that are labeled as organic, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's new effort to crack down on fraud, protect the integrity of products that are considered free of pesticides and other contaminants. Join in with your questions, your comments about certified organic products, 800-642-1234. We have Adam Wortheson, who's Government and Industry Affairs Director at the Farmer-Owned Cooperative Organic Valley. Adam, foods like eggs and milk, they've been hit particularly hard by inflation. I mean, we see this at the grocery store. What effect is rising costs having on the sale of organic food and organic items, which tend to cost more than others?
Yeah, you're right in that acknowledgement. Organic foods do have a premium on them because, you know, it takes a little bit more work for a farmer to create that value-added good. And in the marketplace, especially with inflation, you know, there's less sort of ability to increase prices at the retail level. We've seen a lot of challenges, especially in organic, that's, you know, inflation influence, but on top of inflation, at least within like dairy and eggs, which are needing feedstuffs to feed those animals to create those commodities, feed costs have just gone through the roof. And those feed costs have to do with a couple of global supply chain shocks. So one of them that has really impacted organic farmers has been, ironically, the Russia-Ukraine war. And then secondly, there's been anti-dumping tariffs put in place from product coming in from India. And it's kind of weird to think, what would those two countries have to do with the U.S. grain market? Well, right now, the reality is we do not have enough domestic organic acres and domestic organic grain production to service the livestock industry. You know, many of our farmers, like, they're somewhat feed self-sufficient, but some of them are buying some soybeans or corn. And if you are buying soybeans or corn, there may be international supplies of that.
Mm-hmm.
And those two places, that Ukraine war and also that Indian trade dispute, have just meant we've seen prices increase 30% in 2021 and then another 30% in 2022. So farmers are really struggling to deal with that massive price increase.
And something I learned, it's difficult to tell the difference between organic and non-organic grain, for instance. And I'm just wondering, if you inject a lot of non-organic grain into the organic food system and into feed and into the economy, what does that do to other farmers?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, that's a violation of the law. You know, to put non-organic grains into and pretend it's organic, is, you can't do that. And this new strengthening organic enforcement is going to mean it's going to be harder to cheat, and cheaters are going to get caught. So, you know, those that are honest brokers, you know, we're going to be challenged to find more product. And there is some initiatives underway at the Department of Agriculture to try to bolster organic production and organic acres in the U.S. But what that would do, I mean, it undermines that fundamental trust, you know, concept that we spoke about earlier, that is between consumers and organic farmers. So that's really a you know, something that we can't abide by, and why we're supporting the strengthening organic enforcement, as well as trying to figure out how do we provide more opportunities for farmers who want to grow organic grains or want to get to that place, even if they have an existing operation that might be conventional, but maybe they want to do part of it organic. So we're really interested in trying to facilitate that growth so we have more domestic supply.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the USDA's new regulations for being certified organic. We have Adam Wortheson, who's Director of Government and Industry Affairs for Wisconsin-based Organic Valley. Call in to join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Adam, I want to turn to labeling for a moment. And what should consumers know about the labeling changes when they're at the grocery store?
Well, I mean, I work for an organic food company. And, you know, what I believe and I see as the most powerful seal that sits on a product is the USD organic seal. That means that the integrity behind that was, it was based in a law. There is a set of, you know, like I said, 80 certifiers around the world that are checking on every one of those operations that are providing that product. You know, there's about 44,000 certified operations around the world, and we have about 17,000 organic farmers in the U.S. So to me, that's kind of the top of the pyramid in terms of integrity behind a label on a product in the grocery store. clearly there are all kinds of other options that people really just need to investigate on in what does it bring you, and for farmers, what is the value that it brings you in terms of the premiums it provides if you're going to grow for that type of label or that type of claim.
Let's bring in Terry in Nakusa. Terry, hi.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Interestingly, I think your guest just touched on the answer to my question a little bit. When he's talking about creating a level playing field so that everyone that gets the certified stamp of the USDA, I'm curious how they enforce that outside of the United States. Are they actually doing random calls on farmers and businesses that are bringing things into the United States claiming to be organic? How can they implement and enforce the rules and regulations outside the U.S.?
Terry, thank you. I want to give this back to Adam here on inspections of organic imports.
Yeah, you bet. Terry, that's a good question. You know, anything that's gets that USDA seal has to meet the National Organics Program standards. And those operations that are either bringing in product or they're making it, you know, in another country, they must be certified and they must meet all those regulations. So, you know, that chain of competence extends all the way back to where it's grown on the farm, to where it's processed at, you know, the mill or creamery, all the way to that grocery store. And that strengthening organic enforcement, you know, we did have some challenges in the, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and even more recently, where, especially in the grain market, we had some approaches that were trying to sort of facilitate fraudulent grain. And, you know, now this rule, and I think even before this rule, there's greater oversight and sort of scrutiny of anybody that pretends to say that that's organic barge or ship that's coming over here. And you got to have an import certificate now that's associated with that to ensure that we can follow back all the way to that field that grain was grown on.
Adam, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm really glad to join you, and have a good morning.
You too. Adam Wortheson is Director of Government and Industry Affairs for Organic Valley. It's a national cooperative of 1,800 family farmers based in Lafarge, Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.